think we're good. So first, I would just like to you to just introduce yourself as if you just meet me for the first time with...
Great to meet you.
I'm on the phone with Kim Meredith. She's the executive director of the Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society. They call it PACS, or PACS for short. In February of 2017, she helped found a working group called the Generosity Commission. This group aims to learn about the changes in giving and voluntary action in the United States.
So the Generosity Commission is concerned about some of the new trends that 1% of the donors gave 49% of the gifts in 2017, that fewer and fewer families are engaging in philanthropy and volunteering. We have 20 million less donor households today than we did in 2000.
When I heard this, I was taken aback. I wondered where Kim got these numbers. She told me about an organization called Giving USA. Run by the Indiana University Lilly Family School of Philanthropy, Giving USA has reported trends in giving as far back as 1976.
So when you do all the matchmaking, we have a pretty good story from 1976 until today around giving, who gives, and where that money goes. We know traditionally 80% of giving is individuals, about 15% is foundations, and 5% is corporations. But as we look at the composition of some of those dollars, we see that there are shifts going on. Some of the fastest growing areas of growth are to foundations or to donor-advised funds at a rate of 15 to 20%. Recent years, whereas giving to religion is declining. So what does all of that mean? And if everyday people and families are not participating, what do we need to know about how they see their giving?
What does this all mean? Has the U.S. changed into a selfish, greedy society over the past 20 years? Are 20 million households investing their money elsewhere? Is there something in the Giving USA data that we don't understand? These are the questions that the Generosity Commission is trying to answer. And to do that, they needed some help. They sought out Lucy Bernholtz, the director of the Digital Civil Society Lab at Stanford University. Lucy has been thinking about charitable giving for decades. She has published several books and articles on philanthropy and given talks around the world. Lucy discovered her interest in charitable giving while attempting to answer the foundational question of her career: what's public, what's private, and who decides?
As a resident of the United States, I see a lot of political decisions and historical and contemporary decisions and systems that I think treat some people unjustly. So that leads me to wonder, you know, how in democracies, what's the relationship between democracies and justice? And then when you start throwing in things like, well, where are the bounds of that public decision-making? Where should this be my choice and not the state's? And so a personal story about it had to do with the whole debate about gay marriage and the idea that people would vote on who other people could marry just struck me as ludicrous, to be perfectly honest.
Once Lucy started studying charitable giving, it wasn't long before she started to see the same trends as Kim. When Lucy saw that millions of households had stopped giving, she did not by it.
It just didn't make any sense to me. The research didn't match what I saw going on around me. And I had started a long time ago to ask people to lead these conversations, mostly with people directly in the philanthropic profession, on what they would consider the edge. You know, charitable giving's at the center and shopping is at the edge. And as I was having those conversations more and more frequently, I realized that the very people in the room for whom philanthropy and charitable giving was their professional work, they themselves were paying more attention or talking more about the way they shopped or the things they didn't invest in or the way they tried to live their values through these other behaviors.
According to Lucy's hypothesis, 20 million households haven't shut their doors to their neighbors in need. They have helped them in ways that we cannot measure, ways that are harder to see. Lucy wanted to explore this, and to do so, she needed to talk to folks. Folks from all over, of all walks of life, of all ways of giving. Lucy began to have conversations with people of different communities in hopes of writing a book about how giving has changed over the past 20 years.
I want to tell stories of people using these different ways of giving and give them their full due, not as the edge of something. Actually, for each of the stories of the book, of real people of moderate means from across the country who don't necessarily think of themselves as philanthropists, but who are dedicated to using some or most of these different ways of giving, I want to tell those stories and get them out into the world so that the conversation about philanthropy being the work of old, wealthy, mostly white people can be further debunked.
In her conversations, Lucy asked a simple question. How do you give to make the world a better place? The more that Lucy had these conversations, the more she realized how they helped her understand the changes in giving.
You know, I am 25, 30 years into my career. I've been in this space for a long time, and I am so excited just to listen to people across the country at this time in our shared history talk about how they want to make things better and what they're doing about it, because I think people are doing a lot.
Lucy and the Generosity Commission decided to work together to have these conversations across the country. The Generosity Commission awarded Lucy a $75,000 grant to put together a team and learn more about how people give. This project is titled How We Give Now. The setup of How We Give Now is simple. Get 15 to 20 people in a room and have them brainstorm for about 5 minutes on post-it notes about how they give to make the world a better place. Once they're done, the group will organize the post-its into categories such that similar giving strategies are grouped together. For example, things like donating clothes to the Salvation Army and giving cans during a food drive would be in the same category, while other giving strategies such as giving to your church or donating money to the Red Cross would be in another. When the participants are done with this, the group will discuss what they learned from the process, what surprised them, and what they think influences the ways that they give.
You know, this isn't a survey, and it's not a huge representative sample, and we're not doing psychological tests, and we're not doing A/B testing. There's a lot of things we're not doing. We're really just trying to listen to people and have these conversations in ways that folks might even continue them when we're gone, or might even pass them on to someone else.
These conversations are not just for Lucy and the Generosity Commission. They are also a way for the participants of this project to reflect and learn about the ways they give back. This project is not a traditional number-crunching look at charitable giving, and Lucy hopes that How We Give Now will challenge our current understanding of philanthropy in the U.S.
If there's one thing I really do want to complicate is the sense that charitable giving is the most important way of making a difference in the world. I think it's the most studied way of making a difference. And it's, you know, carefully, at least in the U.S., it's very tracked, and we've studied it a lot, and we've thought a lot about it, and we privilege it in our laws and our policies. And I think it's very important, don't get me wrong, but I don't think it's the full story. I think there's a lot of other things going on, and it's time to start understanding the full suite of what those other activities are, and then thinking about them in relationship to each other.
In July, three research assistants hit the road to hold the How We Give Now workshops. They traveled all over, from California to Ohio to Alabama, speaking to nearly 500 people about how they give. I wanted to talk to someone who had participated in one of the workshops and was connected to Haley Freed from Rapid City, South Dakota. When I talked to Haley on the phone, she was eager to tell me about the first job that she loved at a local candy shop. She worked there for over 6 years, and during that time, she realized the importance of supporting her local economy.
That job that I loved so much that I was at for 6.5 years, it was a local business. And so before that, weirdly enough, like, I was dating the nephew of the owner of that business. And so, like, when I met him, I got really into, like, oh, we should always shop local. But then when I got that job, it really hit me how important it is. It's almost like a magical asset to your community, having a local business. You have your regular customers who talk to you and know you, you know, and they trust you. And just the whole downtown community, like, everybody knows each other, and they're there to help each other and talk with one another and band together if needed.
By working at her local candy store, Haley learned about all of the exciting things that her local businesses had to offer. Not only did she support her local economy by working in a small business, but she also shopped at other local businesses.
I do it because, well, number one, I think there is a really fun selection of things. I mean, I was at a candy store, and so we had the coolest candy ever, you know. But then, like, there's my friend Chance, who has a hanging gallery, so he does framing and stuff and has really nice, like, writing utensils and things and beautiful artwork. So it's so much more fun to go there than to go to, like, you know, Hobby Lobby or something and get a piece of wall art. I do understand why some people don't shop locally. You're not always able to financially. But when I can, when I'm able to shop local, I always do.
Haley shared this way of giving at the How We Give Now workshop, but she also left with a new understanding of the gifts that she received in life.
One woman brought up, it was my favorite thing of the day, that how influencing someone and helping them make connections is a huge way to give. And so that really resonated with me, because that's my first, like, job that I loved. Like, I was there for 6.5 years. My boss was the best influence. She helped me make a ton of connections, and she was able to do that, and she did it, you know. And that's something she didn't have to do. She could have just hired me, paid me, said hello when I came in and bye when I left, but she helped me grow and become a better person.
Haley found out about the job at the candy store from someone she was dating at the time, not knowing that the job would introduce someone so important into her life.
So I met him just kind of I think Twitter or something. Okay. Like, we started talking over Twitter, and then he kept asking me to, like, hang out with him, and I kept saying no. Then one day I did, then we started dating, and through that, you know, I met his aunt, Pam, and I was working at a terrible frozen yogurt shop before that. Mm-hmm. Just bad experience. But, I quit. And then one day we were having his going away, like, barbecue thing. And just by total fluke, I mentioned, you know, how I'd quit that job. And when Pam was walking out the door that night, she yelled in and she's like, Haley, do you want a job? And I was like, sure, you know, and she's like, come in for an interview tomorrow. And my interview consisted of like, do you like candy? Said, yeah. She's like, okay. And kind of the rest was history.
Haley and Pam quickly connected. The candy store soon became one of Haley's favorite places in town.
I stayed there for 6.5 years. I was there on my days off. Like, mm-hmm. She had to force me to take days off. She treated me as a complete equal. Our relationship, like, we call it mind melding. Like, we're mm-hmm. always on the same page. Like, we just totally clicked. And she's always someone I can go to and always someone that I trust. And that was, I don't think there's a day that goes by where I'm not thankful for that experience.
Can you tell me about something that you learned from Pam? What are the type of things that she taught you?
Well, she taught me, like, grown-up things, which was really helpful. So, like, she taught me how to, like, put all of my student loans into one place. That's mm-hmm. not something I knew how to do. My parents didn't go to college, and so they didn't know how to do that. They helped me and continue to help me as much as they can, you know, like, but they don't know the answers to a lot of questions. So, like, with, like, adult things, Pam helped me a ton, you know, like, how to fill out certain forms, how to, like, build my resume professionally, how to go into an interview. I mean, those are things that my parents couldn't really help me with, you know, and I don't know, like, where a young person goes for help if they don't know how. And without Pam, like, I don't know what I would have done.
Though Pam gave Haley important advice to help her through college and beyond, there was other advice that really made an impact.
One thing that she taught me that has always, like, stuck with me is if someone's, like, in a really bad mood, she told me that it's probably something going on in their life, not you. And so that helped me a lot. Another thing that always stuck with me is, like, people either drain you or they inspire you. Choose them wisely. And I can't remember who came up, like, who originally said that, but that's something that she always, always, always reiterated to me when I was struggling with, you know, friends, relationships, certain family members, just community members, you know, like, they drain you or they inspire you. Choose them wisely.
Pam's advice was invaluable to Haley, and their relationship is still strong.
And so you guys, you're still in contact with her? You still hang out?
Yes, we do. And it's funny, so she's gonna turn, we have birthday week together, so her birthday is on the 3rd and mine is on the 5th of October, and she's turning, I think she said, 57 this year, and I'm 24, and so there's an age gap, you know, but we just, like, totally click, and we still try to get together at least once every 3 weeks, because, I mean, we went from seeing each other every single day. The longest we ever were apart was 2 weeks when I was on a trip. I mean, every time we meet up, we're like, oh my gosh, I have so much to tell you, you know, and a lot of it's really stupid stuff, but it's nice to still be in touch with her. I can't see myself having a life without her.
Haley's story helps us remember that there are so many ways to give. Whether it's through shopping locally or providing mentorship and friendship in your community, there is always someone who can benefit from your kindness and generosity. So if we think about what Kim Meredith told us before about how giving has declined, and Lucy's idea about the gaps in the data, I think that we've learned something. Haley's story shows us that we have opportunities to give right in front of us. We can give to our friends, our family, our coworkers, and community. Haley's story also reminds us that there are still people out there giving. And sure, they might not be giving in the ways that we are used to coining as philanthropic, but the way that Haley gives and the impact Pam has made on Haley's life illuminates the ways that non-financial gifts can really improve our lives. If Haley's experience in giving or receiving is familiar to you, let it be a reminder of how generous of a society we live in. This is just one example of how someone chooses to give. And this is one way that giving has bettered someone's life. And this is how we give now.